Welcome back to Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We're up to Book 11, Chapter 2. The forces of a dozen European nations burst into Russia. The Russian army and people avoided a collision till Smolensk was reached, and again from Smolensk to Borodino. The French army pushed on to Moscow, its goal, its impetus ever increasing as it neared its aim, just as the velocity of a falling body increases as it approaches the earth. Behind it were a thousand versts of hunger-stricken hostile country, ahead were a few dozen versts separating it from its goal. Every soldier in Napoleon's army felt this, and the invasion moved on by its own momentum. The more the Russian army retreated, the more fiercely a spirit of hatred of the enemy flared up, and while it retreated, the army increased and consolidated. At Borodino, a collision took place. Neither army was broken up, but the Russian army retreated immediately after the collision, as inevitably as a ball recoils after colliding with another, having a greater momentum. And with equal inevitability, the ball of invasion that had advanced with such momentum rolled on for some distance, though the collision had deprived it of all its force. The Russians retreated 80 miles to beyond Moscow, and the French reached Moscow, and there came to a standstill. For 5 weeks after that, there was not a single battle. The French did not move. As a bleeding, mortally wounded animal licks its wounds, they remained inert in Moscow for 5 weeks, and then suddenly, with no fresh reason, fled back. They made a dash for the Kaluga Road, and after a victory, for at Malo-Yaroslavets, the field of conflict again remained theirs, without undertaking a single serious battle, they fled still more rapidly back to Smolensk, beyond the Berezina, beyond Vilna, and farther still. On the evening of the 26th of August, Kutuzov and the whole Russian army were convinced that the Battle of Borodino was a victory. Kutuzov reported so to the Emperor. He gave orders to prepare for a fresh conflict to finish the enemy, and did this not to deceive anyone, but because he knew that the enemy was beaten, as everyone who had taken part in the battle knew. But all that evening and the next day, reports came in, one after another, of unheard-of losses, of the loss of half the army, and a fresh battle proved physically impossible. It was impossible to give battle before information had been collected, the wounded gathered in, the supplies of ammunition replenished, the slain reckoned up, now officers appointed to replace those who had been killed, and before the men had had food and sleep. And meanwhile, the very next morning after the battle, the French army advanced of itself upon the Russians, carried forward by the force of its own movement, now seemingly increased in inverse proportion to the square of the distance from its aim. Kutuzov's wish was to attack next day, and the whole army desired to do so. But to make an attack, the wish to do so is not sufficient. There must also be a possibility of doing it, and the possibility did not exist. It was impossible not to retreat a day's march, and then in the same way it was impossible not to retreat another and a third day's march. And at last, on the 1st of September, when the army drew near Moscow, despite the strength of the feeling that had arisen in all ranks, the force of circumstances compelled it to retire beyond Moscow, and the troops retired one more last day's march and abandoned Moscow to the enemy. For people accustomed to think that plans of campaign and battles are made by generals, as any one of us sitting over a map in his study may imagine how he would have arranged things in this or that battle, the questions present themselves. Why did Kutuzov, during the retreat, not do this or that? Why did he not take up a position before reaching Philly? Why did he not retire at once by the Kaluga Road, abandoning Moscow? And so on. People accustomed to think in that way forget, or do not know, the inevitable conditions which always limit the activities of any commander-in-chief. The activity of a commander-in-chief does not at all resemble the activity we imagine to ourselves when we sit at ease in our studies examining some campaign on the map, with a certain number of troops on this and that side in a certain known locality, and begin our plans from some given moment. A commander-in-chief is never dealing with the beginning of any event, the position from which he always contemplates it. The commander-in-chief is always in the midst of a series of shifting events, and so he never can at any moment consider the whole import of an event that is occurring. Moment by moment, the event is imperceptibly shaping itself, and at every moment of this continuous, uninterrupted shaping of events, the commander-in-chief is in the midst of a most complex play of intrigues, worries, contingencies, authorities, projects, counsels, threats, and deceptions, and is continually obliged to reply to innumerable questions addressed to him, which constantly conflict with one another. Learned military authorities, quite seriously, tell us that Kutuzov should have moved his army to the Kaluga Road long before reaching Philly, and that somebody actually submitted such a proposal to him. But a commander-in-chief, especially at a difficult moment, has always before him not one proposal, but dozens simultaneously, and all these proposals, based on strategies and tactics, contradict each other. A commander-in-chief's business, it would seem, is simply to choose one of these projects, but even that he cannot do. Events and time do not wait. For instance, on the 28th it is suggested to him to cross the Kaluga Road, but just then an adjutant gallops up from Miloradovich asking whether he is to engage the French or retire. An order must be given him at once, that instant, and the order to retreat carries us past the turn to the Kaluga Road. And after the adjutant comes the commissary general, asking where the stores are to be taken, and the chief of the hospitals asks where the wounded are to go, and a courier from Petersburg brings a letter from the sovereign which does not admit of the possibility of abandoning Moscow, and the commander-in-chief's rival, the man who is undermining him, and there are always not merely one but several such, presents a new project diametrically opposed to that of turning to the Kaluga Road, and the commander-in-chief himself needs sleep and refreshment to maintain his energy, and a respectable general who has been overlooked in the distribution of rewards comes to complain, and the inhabitants of the district pray to be defended, and an officer sent to inspect the locality comes in and gives a report quite contrary to what was said by the officer previously sent, and a spy, a prisoner, and a general, who has been on reconnaissance, all describe the position of the enemy's army differently. People accustomed to misunderstand or to forget these inevitable conditions of a commander-in-chief's actions describe to us, for instance, the position of the army at Philly, and assume that the commander-in-chief could, on the 1st of September, quite freely decide whether to abandon Moscow or to defend it. Whereas, with the Russian army, less than 4 miles from Moscow, no such question existed. Then, had that question been settled, at Drissa and at Smolensk, and most palpably, of all, on the 24th of August at Shevardino and on the 26th at Borodino, and each day and hour and minute of the retreat from Borodino to Philly. All right, there we go, another chapter down, and Tolstoy is again explaining the nature of commanding an army, or the nature of whatever force it is that dictates to an army what it should do. It doesn't always seem to be the person in command. He did a really good job in this chapter of communicating the complexities that a commander-in-chief deals with. He's got to call the shots. Do they abandon Moscow or not? But it's not that simple. There's all this information and misinformation. There's delays in the information and misinformation. He's got to juggle everything that's coming into his head. It's all mismatched. He's got to be able to make a call, conflicting reports. It's an impossible job. It's one of those jobs that, how do you calculate your way out of that? You really can't. I think you've got to act on gut feel mostly. And there's no handbook for how to be good at something like that because it's so complex. You almost have to be a bit of an anomaly of a person to be good at this job. If you can navigate your way through all of this mess and somehow make the right call more often than not, then you've got what it takes to be a good commander-in-chief. Who was once Delight said, Tolstoy says a commander-in-chief is never able to contemplate events and plan for them at the beginning. Instead, he always finds himself in the middle of a shifting series of events, and in such a way that he is never able, at any moment, to ponder all the meaning of the ongoing event. Do you think this is true in life in general? Not just for generals and battle plans, but also for those of us living our lives in peace, as it were. In peace chapters, as it were. That's a cool question. And yeah, I think that's probably the case. You know, you always talk about how, with the benefit of hindsight, decisions that you made or should have made seem so obvious. And the outsider's perspective, when you're outside of a situation, how easy it is to look into someone else's situation and dictate what they should probably do. When you're in the situation, you can't see the forest for the trees, so to speak. So someone who can be in the middle of such a complex chaos and be able to make sense of it in any way, that's a pretty impressive person. I think that relates back to general life too. You often don't see the complexity of a situation until after it's finished and you can look back and examine exactly what was going on. The Shiner said, I'm definitely copying this chapter to give to my military history class. His discussion of the complexity of being a commander is great and could lead to quality discussion, I think. I can see high schoolers appreciating his mix of philosophy and analogy with practical examples. That's really cool, The Shiner, that you teach military history to high schoolers, it seems. That's really awesome. I think you should definitely float that question, that philosophical analogy. Float that with them and see what conversation comes out of it. And hey, I'm sure everyone here at A Year of War and Peace would love to hear what your students have to say about that. Reddit user 100157 said, I think this is in line with his general program of undermining the great man theory of history. Huge events and theatres are just too complex to attribute to the will of an individual, no matter how talented. I would think Tolstoy feels this only applies to a much lesser degree when it comes to ordinary people and their lives, although I think there too he is aware of how passions, tradition and circumstance interfere with rational decision-making. I like this point that Tolstoy is making about the impossible complexity of a thing like war, and even how it's almost impossible to explain exactly why the French continued on to Moscow, and then why they left Moscow 5 weeks later. I liked that analogy about the ball colliding with another ball at a greater speed. And so the Russians were knocked back, much further back than Moscow, after the collision. And the French kept going in the same direction, but at a slower pace. I can imagine that, although it still doesn't really explain why they did it. I think they were just on their way there, so they kept moving. Anyway, that's going to do us for this episode. Thanks for listening. I will see you tomorrow.